This is Virginia Insight. I'm Peter Norton, sitting in for Tom Graham. Are you a techie or are you artsy? Do you like the latest digital gadgets or is a good novel more your thing? Maybe you don't have to choose. What if we could use the power of digital technology to open up new worlds in the arts, in literature, and in history? It turns out we can. Digital humanities people use the latest technology to map time as well as space and to experience and explore creative works in unexpected ways. Some of them you can try yourself. Dr. Bethany Novisky is director of the Scholars Lab and of the Department of Digital Research and Scholarship at the University of Virginia Library. Dr. Paul Youngman is professor and head of the Department of German and Russian at Washington and Lee University, where he also chairs the Digital Humanities Working Group. We'll talk to them right after the news. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Peter Norton, sitting in for Tom Graham. We're talking today about the humanities, the arts, literature, history, and other creative fields. We're actually talking about computers, data, information, apps. Actually, we're talking about both. The digital humanities lets us apply the power of the latest computers to novels, poetry, the arts, and history. Our guests are practicing experts in the digital humanities. We'll hear from them in a moment, but we want to hear from you, too. Have you used computers to explore the arts? Would you like to know how you can explore novels with your laptop or your smartphone? Maybe you're a teacher and you'd like some ideas to bring to your students. You can call us at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Our guests are Bethany Novisky and Paul Youngman. Bethany Novisky holds a PhD in English from the University of Virginia, where she directs the Scholars Lab and UVA Library's Department of Digital Research and Scholarship. She was named one of the Chronicle of Higher Education's 10 Tech Innovators for 2013. The Chronicle's article about these innovators begins, "Bethany Novisky likes to build things." Paul Youngman is professor and head of the Department of German and Russian at Washington and Lee University. He also chairs Washington and Lee's Digital Humanities Working Group. He's the author of We Are the Machine, about how computing technologies affect German culture. Bethany Novisky and Paul Youngman, welcome to Virginia Insight.
Thanks.
Thanks, Peter.
I'd like to begin at the beginning. I think I know what the humanities are. I have a general idea, but could you all pin it down for me? What makes all these things the humanities?
It's a good start. Better to start with the humanities than the digital. We'll do the digital
pretty
soon. The humanities are the collection of fields like religion, literary and cultural studies, philosophy, history, those fields that analyze, interpret, and critique the human cultural record. You know, that can be music, that can be art, that can be literary studies. Humanists can even study science, even though some people see that as sort of a dichotomy.
And Bethany, would you have anything to add to that, or is that?
I think Paul really covered it. And Peter, your introduction when you mentioned the creative arts as well is an important aspect of this. It's sort of positioning us in time and space, right?
So, if you guys are both humanities scholars, and that's correct, right?
Yes.
Then help me understand how you went from being humanities scholars to also being information technology people, digital scholars.
I'll let Bethany go first on that.
Okay, sure. Well, I got my start in the digital humanities quite early. So when I was an undergraduate student, I also did my undergraduate degree at UVA. Several of my professors were getting involved with bringing their research online, exploring new computer technology to do their work differently. And I was both an archaeology major and an English major, and I had a professor in each of those fields who was involved with what was then a new institute at UVA, the Institute for Advanced Technology in the Humanities. And I watched their excitement and was really sort of energized by that. So my archaeology professor, John Dobbins, is an expert in the city of Pompeii and was doing lots of sort of mapping of buildings and ruins there and was able to sort of see that city differently. My English professor was Jerome McGann, who was then starting a big digital edition of a Victorian poet and painter, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, who both, you know, sometimes he would write a poem about a painting he was working on, and sometimes he would make a sketch or a painting based on some poetry that he was writing. And so so Jerry McGann was thinking about how you could put those two things into conversation with each other in a way that wasn't really possible for scholars who were constrained by the form of the book. You know, you were never going to get a press to publish all of the sketches and paintings. And once you had them online, you might be able to look at them differently. So that was really sort of early in my understanding of the humanities. So it's interesting that you start with, you know, what are the humanities? Because that's when I was figuring out what the humanities are.
I would love to hear more about what you mean by constrained by the form of the book.
Mm-hmm.
First, I'd like to hear from Paul Youngman about his how he got into the digital
side. I'd like to
talk
about that too. We're constrained by the book. We'll come to that. I come to this from a very traditional humanities route, whereas the Chronicle says Bethany likes to build things, Paul can't build things, but I like to write. And I wrote my first book on the railway, always intending it to be sort of a comparative work with an analysis of the computer and the information network in Germany. And so I ended up writing my second one on that very topic, because the two are actually very similar in their cultural reception, railway and computer. And the book We Are the Machine, you can't write in depth about the computer without realizing or without beginning to get a glimpse of where it's going. So whereas in the early part of the 20th century, it was all about these novels trying to capture the computer on the pages of the novel. And now as we move forward into the 21st century, we're seeing the novels being captured on the screen of the computer. So we've had this sort of interesting reversal that's gone on. And I wrote that book, and the dean at my last institution assumed that I must be a digital humanities person, so she asked me if I would like to head up a digital humanities initiative at my last institution. So I had a lot of on-the-job training with that.
I think at this point we need to, or I need some help understanding exactly what you mean by the digital humanities. So we started out, you guys helping me understand what the humanities are, but what is the digital part of what you all do? I mean, this is more than just reading novels on a iPad or something like this, right?
Yeah, I bet we have two different answers. I'll take a crack at, you know, in my mind, it's a recognition that the digital turn is here to stay. And by the digital turn, I mean the fact that information no longer primarily conserves itself in these textual objects that we call books. There are so many other forms of media. And the fact that information, i.e. books, poems, whatever other works of art, are available in that different format, there are different things we can do to those things for analysis or research. And the recognition of that is what digital humanities is to me.
Yeah, no, that makes good sense to me. I think I would go back to the sort of core questions of the humanities, or the core kind of orientation that humanities scholars and interested readers and viewers of artworks and so forth take toward the things that they're studying, and those are deeply interpretive questions. We want to understand how artworks are put together. We want to understand what authors mean, you know, what is it that they're intending when they write? How do they fit into their context? How do they fit into their sort of historical place? How do they fit into the physical world that they inhabit? So the digital humanities, to me, are just another set of tools that humanities scholars have always embraced new ways to figure these things out. The minute that that microfilm was available, you know, humanities
right.
scholars went for that.
Yeah.
Now our resources are increasingly available online. They're going for that. Humanities scholars have been building devices to help them manage their information and study their objects of study more carefully forever. And so so this is just an extension of it. I see it as a continuum, not a break
sure.
or something sort of brand new.
Sure, the book is one of those devices.
Absolutely, yeah. We talked about the yeah, exactly. I said something that caught your attention a little while ago about the constraints of the book. And right, it's true. The book has always been an amazing sort of engine for meaning. Right, There are all kinds of sort of devices that we're familiar with embedded in books. We've got indices, we've got glossaries, we've got the convention of breaking things up into chapters and so forth.
But it's a device that we're so used to, we just sort of take it
for granted that it's a device.
Yeah, and then we think that what we're doing now is so constructed because it's digital, which is sort of debatable.
We're talking about the digital humanities with scholars Bethany Novisky and Paul Youngman, who are practitioners of the field. I wonder if you could give us, our listeners, a more specific example of how we might understand a particular author, a particular book, a particular body of literature in a new way without the constraint of the book as a paper document. Is there something there we could find that we couldn't find in some other way?
Yeah, I mean, I could tell you a little story about some scholars at UVA who are studying probably one of the most studied texts in the world, and that is Homer. So they're reading the catalog of ships from Homer's Iliad. Your readers may recall this passage in the Homer's story of the Great Battle of Troy, when there's a kind of listing of all of the places from whence troops come to fight the battle. And it's this long, it's why it's called a catalog. It's a long catalog of all of the, you know, the men of Thebes come and the men of Boeotia come and so forth. Jenny Strauss Clay, who is a classics professor at UVA, cold called me on the phone one day. I was in my office. The phone rang. I'd never met her or talked to her before. And she was on the line asking me if computers could help her understand this much, much studied text in ways that were not otherwise possible, because she had a theory. And her theory was that the order in which the ships were named meant something, but she wasn't sure exactly what. So the theory she was starting to develop was that, the Iliad and the Odyssey are these great oral poems. They were at first not written down at all. They had to be memorized. And so the question that she wanted to know is, like, how could somebody possibly memorize this long catalog of place names?
I'm beginning to think about that memory trick a lot of us learned as kids, about how you remember the order of the planets by their first letter of the word for each planet adding up to a rhyme. I can't remember the rhyme
anymore.
Well,
it's kind of like, when you learn music, you learn every good boy does fine.
That's what I mean. Was it that kind of thing?
It was sort of like that. I mean, another kind of famous, these are called Ars Memoria, the arts of memory. And another kind of famous one of these is to imagine a space and hook the things that you're trying to remember to your imagination of a place. And this is exactly what Jenny was starting to think might be happening in the Iliad. So she was thinking that maybe the way Homer remembered to say all these places in a particular order was because he was visualizing them on a map. And therefore, maybe they actually traced real trade routes or real sort of roads you might go along in the ancient world. And that's what she wanted to test. And she was calling me because she knew that in the Scholars Lab at UVA Library, we're into maps and we like to do things with space and place. And so we brought her in with a couple of her graduate students and hooked her up with our GIS experts, and that means geospatial information systems, so the computery side of maps, to talk about how you might study that sequence if you knew something about the terrain of ancient Greece. And they had a really wacky idea. And so the wacky idea was this. Our GIS specialist said, well, there's this weird technique that that the Department of Highways uses to lay out roads. And I guess when we come back, I'll tell you more.
I can't wait. Welcome back to Virginia Insight. We're talking with Bethany Novisky and Paul Youngman, two digital humanities scholars. You can join the conversation at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Where we left off, Bethany Novisky was telling us about a scholar who had an intriguing hypothesis about the ships named in Homer's Iliad. And we were about to find out whether this hypothesis proved correct or not when we had our break. Bethany, can you tell us some more about that?
Right. So Jenny Strauss Clay and her graduate students came into the Scholars Lab at UVA Library, and our computer mapping specialists had an interesting idea. And the idea was to use a technique in spatial software that is mostly used by the Department of Highways to figure out where's the best place to lay out a road.
So highway location techniques being applied to Homer's Iliad.
Exactly. And that's why I love this story, because it's so sort of unexpected.
Yeah.
And I think this may have been one of the first uses, if not the first use, of this particular tool and technique for a humanities question. But what they said that we could do is, if we had a map of the terrain of ancient Greece, we could use this technique called least cost path analysis. Now that's I had to rehearse saying that. It's called least cost path because it helps you figure out what's the least costly path to lay your road on. So
this sounds like my walk to school as a kid. It was always find the shortest path to take.
Exactly. You know? Well, it's in part the shortest path, but it's also, you want to avoid steep hills. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure that you don't go off a cliff. You don't want to walk through the water, because right. That would imply you need to build a bridge. So we were doing least cost path analysis for travel by mule in ancient Greece. Mm. And sure enough, when you plug in these city names in the particular order in which they were given from the Iliad, you could start to see patterns. There were some real sequences that made sense on the map of ancient Greece.
And when you say you could see these, do you mean you're looking at a map and you're looking at these actual hypothesized pathways?
That's right. We pulled in information that archaeologists and classic scholars have accumulated about where most of these cities are, and we plotted those on a map, and we ran the algorithm that told us how they sort of relate to each other and whether you could sort of reasonably draw roads and lines among them. And it really did work. In some cases, the classic scholars and the graduate students particularly went back in, looked at it, and were able to formulate some alternate hypotheses, like maybe Homer's imagining Greece sort of like a clock and there are regions and he's sort of moving through them like that. But in some cases, there really were sort of A, B, C, D sequences that you could see in the list of these city names.
Does this mean that the scholar who had this hypothesis was finding that the answer was yes?
Pretty much, yeah. And what's really interesting about it is that some of those named places in Homer's catalog of ships have never been discovered archaeologically. They are lost cities. So if the computer-assisted technique is indicating to us that, 90% of the time when they're listed in a particular order, that order means something spatially on the map, it's a hint as to where, you might dig here between cities, the A, B, blank, D. You might look for city C right in there.
So
somewhere.
You've got some clues about where there might be the next buried city like Troy.
Yes, exactly. And fascinatingly, uh-huh. The clues don't come at this point, although, the next phase of the project would be, and indeed the scholars did then go out and do some field work over the summer. They went taking photographs of interesting areas and sort of checking out the landscape in person. But it's really interesting that the clues are coming from the poetry, right? And
incredible.
And the most studied poem around. This was hidden information in the poem, and it could have only been gotten out through new computer techniques.
Well, that's fascinating.
And the nice thing about it too is that it it starts with it with that just a traditional humanities question, and is there an alternate way that I can approach this?
Exactly. It starts with
the kind of call you want to get.
Yeah, it starts with close reading. You know, I've been reading this passage again and again and again, and I'm starting to see a pattern. I need help seeing it better.
That's really interesting.
Do you find connections with your work?
Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, when you hear Bethany talk, you hear a lot about space. And I think that one subset of digital humanities is something that we call spatial humanities. And it's been one of the nicer aspects for my research, especially, because you can kind of claim space in a different way than when you're using your words, right? When you're writing about space, it's very your vocabulary is limited, right? Can you describe the shape of the United States? Can you describe the shape of Canada, for example? But with these techniques, I can see things in a much more palpable way. We, for example, my research assistant Gabby Trimo and I this summer set out, of course, digital humanities projects start off massive. We thought we would map every literary the railway and all literature of Europe. And then we narrowed it down to Germany. And then we narrowed it down to just one author, Theodor Fontana, who's sort of the Dickens of Berlin. And then we narrowed it down to one novel of his. That's where we got. But what we did was the railway plays a very central role in this novel. And we mapped the railways. We mapped the travel space onto a map from the era that the book was written. And we have the travel timetables from that era. We have photos of all the train stations and so forth. And in fact, we did learn that least cost path analysis is not what they do when they're laying railways down. But it's interesting when you look at the result of that. So you have all of the railway trips in this novel laid out. And it's very hard to read the novel the same way once you've seen this happen, because a lot of the criticism about this novel talks about sort of the eastward bent of this novel. It tends east in its symbolism and its imagery. But the travel space is very much north-south, was very much a westward bent. So we're able to see new things about this novel this map.
This is because you were able to sort of ask questions of this novel that would be hard to answer without the help of these tools.
Well, a little back, I should say, you know, one of my approaches to digital humanities is I've been taking for the past few years my first book called Black Devil and Iron Angel about the railway in Germany, and subjecting my conclusions that I drew using traditional humanities methods to digital humanities methods now. And I've done that with a couple of different projects, and this is just one of them. And it does show different things.
Can you give me an example? I mean, you gave me the one about the what you called, I think, the supposed eastward bent not actually bearing out. So help me understand how in any novel there could be questions we can't easily answer without the help of tools. I mean, can you count words? Can we see patterns with maybe thousands or even millions of other books?
Absolutely.
Perhaps you could tell me about a tool that you can use to discover something we couldn't discover just by dealing directly with the paper.
That's another thing you can do. Absolutely, what this sort of mining exercise that you suggest. So here's just a very simple example. When I wrote my master's thesis many, many years ago, it was about this author Fontana and the instances of the composer the relationship between him and the German composer Richard Wagner. And that took a lot of work. I had to read all of Fontana's novels, and I was picking and choosing for all of the places where Wagner or allusions to Wagner show up in the work. And right now, that is about a 30-second project, because you can mine those novels of Fontana and find all the instances very quickly using any number of tools. The one that comes to mind for me is Voyant tools, where you just put the text in there, and it scans the text for those relationships for you. That's not to say the research is done, though. Because then you really do have to start either asking questions or developing it even more. Because one of the critiques of digital humanities is, oh, that's just counting. And that's really not just counting. It's not what we're doing there.
So you're learning more than just numbers.
Absolutely.
We're talking to digital humanities scholars Bethany Novisky and Paul Youngman. You can join the conversation at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. I'd like to continue this notion about mining, as you put it, books and other written works for the words in them and what we might learn from them. And in particular, I'd like to ask you about techniques that maybe our listeners can try themselves, because I understand that there are some out there that you don't have to have access to a giant computer. Maybe your laptop with Google or your smartphone can let you use some tools that digital humanities people use as well. One we've talked about off-air was called Google Ngram Viewer. Could we talk about that a little bit and what our listeners might try with that?
Sure. That's a really neat, yeah, just Google Ngram Viewer or Ngram Viewer, and it'll come up. And what it does is it establishes cultural trends by word frequency, essentially. So in the year 1933, the number of times the word railway appears divided by the total number of words that are available. So what the guys did up at MIT, what do they call themselves, their lab?
It's the Culturomics.
The Culturomics lab. What they did was scan a bunch of books online, a good percentage of Google books, and made the corpus of words available. So let's say the word railway shows up 0.00% of the time in 1933. Well, you do that over the years, and on the graph, you get sort of a trend line. And it's kind of fun to put in different terms in there. You can put, you know, for example, just the two things that I've been talking about, if you put in railway and computer in there, each as a 1 gram, you can find the exact point where computers pass the railway as a cultural trend. It's very interesting.
Well, I have to tell you that after we talked about this off air, I tried a little playing around myself, and I was very interested in some of the things I could find. So, for example, I tried comparing the frequency of the words drunkenness and alcoholism because I thought,
good choices.
You know,
yeah.
I was thinking, how did we come to think of this condition mm-hmm. as something that is like an affliction we can treat rather than as like a moral failure
yeah.
of some kind? And so maybe one of you'd like to guess when, in fact, alcoholism became more frequent than drunkenness?
When was the AA founded? Was there something?
Maybe that's a factor. I don't know if that's a factor.
1958. Just
Paul,
a guess.
You are within 5 years.
Wow.
It was in the mid-50s. You're
yeah,
actually within
thought.
2 or 3 years.
Interesting.
I can't remember the exact year. But anyway.
I have a lot of experience in that area.
what struck me forcefully about that little experiment was, you know, this is not a question you could ask without the help of massive data processing, and you can actually see, I think, the culture changing. In other words, the culture is saying it's not just it's not a moral failure so much as a medical like condition that can be treated, and you know that's a huge change. And I began to think of, you know, how many other fascinating
sure.
trends
mm-hmm.
can
right.
you watch by counting. So my understanding is Google has scanned millions of books, dumped the words into massive databases, and Google Ngram Viewer is just a way to search that. Is that correct?
That's
correct.
Right. It's reading off of that huge collection that was built by scanning the collections of university libraries
yeah.
primarily.
So listeners to this program can go to their laptop or their iPhone, type in Ngram Viewer into Google.
Sure.
And just enter a couple of words and plot these for themselves, right?
Sure. That's right, and just start to play around.
Yeah.
I mean, I always find that that's the best way to explore any kind of digital humanities tool, is just to play around not to be too nervous about it. You're never going to break them so badly that you can't, you know, restart them or refresh your browser. And so just play away.
And it's fun, but for the researcher, though, it's not research, but maybe that year 1958 then becomes my point of interest now, right? That becomes my
yeah.
focus. Or that
right.
year when railway passes computer, then I can dive in using other techniques, digital or not, and develop a research paper or something
yeah.
based on those
that,
points.
That's what I find a lot of digital humanities tools excellent for,
yeah.
just
Jump
for
off.
Drawing my attention to something that needs more exploration. And the exploration might happen entirely offline. But some kind of little anomaly, some kind of little blip that catches your eye when you start to visualize information is often really helpful in sort of sparking your imagination for a new project.
So besides Ngram Viewer, are there other tools that listeners who don't have access to a major research center can use from their laptop, from their iPhone, or from something else?
Yeah, well, you know, actually, many, if not most, digital humanities tools are accessible to anybody. You don't need to be affiliated with a university or have a really sophisticated lab to use them. There's a kind of core ethos in the digital humanities community about making these things accessible. The software is often open source so that anybody can run it and adapt it and modify it. The content, as much as possible, this community likes to put things out there in the world as open access so that people can read them and analyze them and build off of them. So that's just a little preamble to say.
But it's a really important aspect of digital humanities, yeah. This openness and sharing.
That's right. That's right. So I don't. So I wouldn't want listeners to think that, you know, not being affiliated with the university is any kind of hurdle to experimenting with these tools. Paul mentioned Voyant a little while ago, which is kind of like Google Ngrams on steroids. Yeah. It's got all kinds of extra little gadgets and widgets attached to it. That's spelled V-O-Y-A-N-T. And it's built by some Canadian researchers, Stefan Sinclair and Jeffrey Rockwell and others. And in that case, it lets you pull in the books and collections that you want to analyze. So I think there's some capacity for building off of Google Books and things like that, or the HathiTrust, which is a sort of scholarly open version of that.
So listeners can find and use Voyant?
Yeah, you can just Google Voyant.
Voyant tools.
All right, V-O-Y-A-N-T. And then they get to select the works that they search instead
yeah,
of...
Yeah, so say you're really into Jane Austen, and you can pull these Jane Austen texts
off. I'm sure some of our listeners are.
Right, well, me too. You can pull them off of Gutenberg books or, you know, lots of sort of open online collections. Bring the full texts of them into a tool like Voyant, and then you start to get pictures out of them. And some of the pictures are these things called word clouds, which are easy to sort of grasp and see. And I'm sure everybody has seen these. There are these visualizations where the most frequently used words appear larger and the least frequently used words appear smaller. But there are also all kinds of other more sophisticated graphs and charts and things that you can hash up your Jane Austen and see it differently.
And you can either, if you take the time, you can, of course, copy and paste and put it into Voyant, or you can just take the link from Gutenberg, put it into Voyant, and it analyzes the book. It's pretty impressive little.
So supposing, you know, I did that with the collected works of Jane Austen, could I ask a question like, did her interests in her fiction change over the course of her writing career, or could I ask another kind
yes.
of question?
Yeah.
And could you help me a little bit understand what you might discover, or perhaps even tell me about something you have discovered through techniques like this?
Well, I mean, I think that the example I was giving before with my master's thesis, I haven't done it, but you could do it, and it would be, you know, it would show over time in the series of Fontana's novels the influence of the composer Wagner. I could look at his importance, his relative importance, just using something simple like the word cloud. But there's more to it than that. There's percentages of hits and so forth that come on. It's word frequency and so forth.
We'll be talking more about it after the break. We are back. We are talking with Bethany Novisky and Paul Youngman. They are digital humanities scholars. They're people who make new discoveries in the humanities with the assistance of digital tools. And I'd like to begin this segment by asking Bethany Novisky about something I read that she said that I found particularly intriguing. So, Bethany, you said that digital humanities people peer with microscopes and macroscopes, looking into things we cannot see. And I thought that was a very intriguing comment, and I really wanted to know more about what your microscopes are and what your macroscopes are and what things we cannot see that we might be able to see with digital humanities.
Great, yeah. And we've been talking along these lines sort of already.
Yeah.
We talked a bit about how I think both Paul and I see digital humanities tools and approaches as a way to help scholars focus their attention on new things or make small discoveries that then they can delve into to a greater extent. But the microscopes and macroscopes thing. So the macroscopes, that's this data mining, text mining. Some people call it distant reading that we've been talking about with tools like Voyant and Google Ngrams and so forth. Ways to read across huge collections. You know, I mentioned a Jane Austen collection that you might analyze. Well, that's reasonable, more than reasonable. It's yeah. You know, great to read the complete works of Jane Austen. But what if you wanted to study all English poetry? Right? You could reasonably spend the rest of your life reading all English poetry, and you might not really be able to express something that cuts across so much work. So distant reading are these text mining approaches that let you delve into very, very large collections.
What about the microscopes?
So I mentioned microscopes on the other hand. And I think I was thinking there both of, you know, people talk a lot about big data now. And I love small data. I love to be able to pay close attention to, you know, little texts and little artifacts and objects. And some of my favorite examples of work happening in digital humanities now are using computer-assisted techniques to actually read things that we thought were not legible anymore. So, for instance, the eruption of Vesuvius.
This is Pompeii?
That destroyed the cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum. Herculaneum was pretty well preserved because it got covered with mudslides and so forth. And there's a collection of papyri, of like papyrus scrolls, that looked like they were being bundled up to be removed from the vicinity when the volcano started to erupt. But they weren't removed fast enough, so they were basically flash fried into little charcoal briquettes. They really do look like little pieces of charcoal.
And there's no way you could get a single letter out of that, is there?
Well, that's what archaeologists and, you know, the scholars who first looked at them thought. Fortunately, they saved them, even though they were these crumbling little blocks of charred paper, because now we can use a technique called spectroscopy to read the texts, to sort of digitally reconstruct them, to see things about the ink on the papyrus, and actually begin to read them.
Has something intelligible been recovered yet?
I think it's a work in progress, but certainly, another example I could cite is work happening at the University College of London on the Great Parchment Book. So a colleague of mine, Melissa Terrace, and her collaborators are taking this book that in the 1600s was burned in a fire and damaged with water. It's all crinkled up. The pages are brittle. And they've been able to scan them and apply a computer vision technique to sort of virtually flatten out the sheets. You couldn't physically flatten them out. They would crumble and break. Hmm. But they've been able to virtually flatten them out. And in that case, it's amazing. I mean, the text is as clear as day.
So they have recovered the text.
Absolutely. You can read the whole thing.
And presumably you couldn't have recovered it by any other manual
technique. No, I mean, people have been, you know, sort of working on it for a very long time. So there were just regions of it that were too crumpled up to unfold and get to.
There's something else I'd like to talk about in our remaining time, and that has to do with digital humanities in the classroom. All right, so we all read novels and Shakespeare and so on in class, and my experience of it was that the teacher was the authority, and I would learn about these great works of literature with her help. But I understand, especially from you, Paul Youngman, that you're empowering students with digital humanities techniques to explore works in their own ways and make discoveries in them. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So that's been a big focus since I've come to Washington and Lee. We envisioned the standard end of term paper as sort of a one-on-one conversation between the professor and the student. What we've started encouraging faculty to do is come up with a digitized project that allows the students to have a conversation with a broader audience, basically literally publish their works so that other folks can read them. So, for example, in one of my 18th century literature classes, the classic project for them at the end is a web-based project that involves familiarizing them with tools that range from the macroscope to the microscope, asking them to subject the works of literature to data mining, to mapping, to topic modeling and different things, so that they do perhaps have a chance to show me something, to reveal something to me in the text that I didn't know.
Maybe you could tell us about one student's project, or maybe
it's a group.
This is collaborative.
It's so collaborative.
You could tell us perhaps about one collaborative project that actually the students became your teachers in, maybe.
Sure. That's actually a great point, too, that you bring up, Peter. Collaboration is another really important part of this ethos, and that's not traditional humanities ethos. Humanities, generally the fevered scholar working alone in his cell, coming up with a great work of genius. But this is collaborative. So our students work together in groups to produce these projects. And, for example, they had to do, this is a couple of years ago, we were approaching this German play called Iphigenia in Tauris, and it's a work of German classicism, and German classicism was sort of a pendulum swing away from something called storm and stress period, which was filled with emotion and so forth. And they mined Iphigenia, this work that was about reason and rationality, and they found that the most frequently occurring word is Herz, and German means heart, which sort of suggests emotions more than it does reason and rationality. Yeah. So that was a nice jumping off point for some analysis for them. And it was also something that was newly revealed to me as well.
So there were some assumptions about the nature of this body of literature.
Not just assumptions. It's the canonical understanding of this. Yeah.
This was sort of like the official conventional wisdom about it.
Yeah.
And your students have challenged that.
Sure.
And they've challenged it in a way that, you know, is pretty compelling, because it's not just, you know, a feeling. It's a documentable,
evidence-based.
Yes, yeah. Thank you.
And you know, it's not just in the classroom too. Mm-hmm. At a place like Washington and Lee, it's important to get students involved in your research. And I have, as I mentioned, my research assistant is very, very well versed in computer tools and so forth. And you know, it's just been a great partnership. And that's a central part of this as well for us, is to get students involved.
There are sure to be a few teachers listening, high school, middle school, maybe even elementary school people could use something with their students that perhaps the students themselves can do, they can do together.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you have some ideas that we could share with our teachers?
Yeah. And this is actually a tool that my students built. So I kind of like the aspect of that a student-built tool gets picked up in the classroom. Mm. So a group of my graduate students built a tool called Prism, and I'll describe what it is in a minute, that surprised us by that they, when they created it, they thought that their audience was going to be maybe university teachers, maybe other groups of young scholars like themselves. And to their great surprise, the K-12 education world picked it up, and it started to be talked about at education conferences. And suddenly there were hundreds of classes of elementary school students and middle school students and high school students using this tool. So the tool is called Prism, and you can find it at prism.scholarslab.org. And it's also a very simple and kind of fun tool to use. We haven't talked about crowdsourcing yet, but that's something that has gotten a lot of attention in the digital humanities. That's the notion that many hands make light work is usually the way you think about that. So if there's a task that is too big for one person to do alone, like, say, transcribing thousands and thousands of documents, maybe people might like to volunteer to do one or two, and all together we could accomplish the task.
Is this like the Wikipedia model where a Wikipedia article is written by perhaps 100 different volunteers?
It's definitely akin to that. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it's kind of a challenge to, you know, Paul was talking about the sort of lone scholar in his office or the sage on the stage kind of model. But often in the digital humanities, crowdsourcing has been used for things like transcription of manuscripts or correction of OCR, which is optical character recognition, that that is the technique by which books are scanned.
So in other words, when a book is scanned, a computer has to figure out what mm-hmm. these letters are.
That's right, and make them into words that can then be read and processed. And they don't always get it right.
Okay.
So human beings then often need to go back in and say, okay, well, you know, machine, you missed this.
I really love hearing about humans correcting and scolding machines. That's a pleasure to hear.
Oh, we correct, we scold, we direct them, we're...
I mean, digital humanities is about staying ahead of machines, really, instead of having our field dictated by machines. I want to add a little bit more about education as well, and especially for middle school, high school, and students in the liberal arts. These are skills that they have to learn. You know, the world doesn't revolve solely around text and print media anymore. And for our liberal arts graduates at Washington Lee, it's important for us that they begin to graduate with a set of skills that they can take into the real world as well, into the job market with them.
So an English major or a history major will graduate from Washington and Lee and likely have some skills that we don't normally think of as history major or English major skills.
Right. That's right? The process that's in place right now.
So could these skills actually find expression in a humanities-centered career, or is that
absolutely.
Is that far-fetched?
Absolutely. We taught our first Digital Humanities 101 course, my colleague Sarah Sprenkel, who's a computer scientist, and I last spring. We had one student in there who was going off to work at Google, very much a digital-oriented career, and another student who was going to work for USA Triathlon, I think, as a and needed those skills with her, and she really appreciated the course because she learned all those.
Well, actually, the humanities, you know, as a broad field, desperately needs students, you know, who have a deep appreciation for arts and literature and culture and who want to be part of the vast transformation that our whole cultural archive is, being swept up in right now.
Are there careers in the humanities that are new because of the new digital tools that people can bring to the humanities with them? In other words, like, could you graduate from the humanities because you love the humanities? I mean, why else major in the humanities? And maybe have opportunities that didn't exist before this digital revolution?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, if you think about the way journalism has been transformed, for instance, you know, people are needing to be able to do digital storytelling in new ways. Libraries are utterly transformed and need staff, need librarians who can help people discover things online, who can help people use new tools, who can help students and scholars and the general public sort of become co-creators. And so that kind of gets back to the crowdsourcing thing that I was talking about earlier in this PRISM tool. So a lot of those crowdsourcing tasks that we think of as the sort of quintessential ones struck my students as a little boring and a little, you know, less than a task that you, like, it wasn't something that only a human being could do. You know, hopefully we could eventually train computers to do a better job at OCR. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we could eventually train them, and people are working on this. Paleographers are working on this. We could train them to transcribe manuscript handwriting, right? So do we need people performing that kind of labor? What's the thing that only a human being can add to an interaction with digital texts, with an interaction with novels and poetry online? And that is their personal interpretation, their subjective response, their feelings about the text, their explanations of it. So this tool that my students built called PRISM is a way to crowdsource interpretation.
Yeah.
So the idea is you put in a little passage of text, and then you invite all your friends or all your fellow students in a class, or your students if you're the teacher, to mark it up with virtual highlighter pens. So you might get three different colors, and you kind of color on top of the text to associate certain words with certain, you know, feelings that are attached to the color.
Extraordinary. And Paul, do you find opportunities for students that graduate from Washington and Lee that didn't exist before?
Well, yes. I mean, mostly the sort of things that Bethany's talking about. I mean, they would go on to graduate school and find alternative academic careers like Bethany's. Bethany herself is a good example, I think, of somebody who has forged a new path given what's been available in the digital humanities.
So we have listeners, I'm sure, who have children ready for college, contemplating the humanities, and maybe thinking, "I that's just not practical. I better stay away from it." But perhaps they have more to hope for.
Absolutely.
We've been talking with Dr. Bethany Novisky, director of the Scholars Lab and of the Department of Digital Research and Scholarship at the University of Virginia, and Professor Paul Youngman, professor and head of the Department of German and Russian at Washington and Lee University, where he also chairs the Digital Humanities Working Group. Bethany Novisky and Paul Youngman, thank you so much for sharing your insights today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. It's been a great pleasure.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producer is Bob Levicki and Dan Easley. Some of our break music is supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks to you, the listeners, for tuning in to this edition. I'm Peter Norton, guest hosting for Tom Graham today. It's been a pleasure being with you. Join us again for more Insights.